Welcome underground. Let's not beat about the bush. My co-host has got into bird watching. He likes sitting quietly in his garden, bewitched by the pied wagtails as they flit about, wagging their tails. We dig into how this might have happened. We suspect it's a heady mix of the British urge to classify things, healthy outdoor walks, and the hunting instinct that is innate to all of us. Plus, birds are beautiful. Enjoy.
I have a confession, which is that I have felt the first stirrings of what I think could be the desire to be a bird watcher.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well,
how did this happen? Were you looking out your window?
I think so. I think I was looking out my window, actually a few years ago, when I lived in Surrey, at what I now know are pied wagtails. And they were sort of flitting around the bins out the back of where I lived. And, you know, just kind of darting around doing and wagging their tails, as wagtails do. They literally do wag their tails. And I just thought they're just very charming and fascinating and lovely to look at, you know, darting about here and there. Something about, you know, they're quick. There's that quickness to songbirds, small birds, that is quite mesmeric. And I found myself slightly mesmerised. And I kind of looked at them and I thought, gosh, look at those wagging tails. Isn't that funny? And then something in my head goes, they're wagtails. I was like, oh, yeah, I do actually know that word from somewhere. They must be wagtails. Look, their tails are wagging. And I thought, I'm going to go and check that. And so I did. I went off and I typed in, you know, what do wagtails look like? And then, lo and behold, they were wagtails, pied wagtails. And that gave me a, you know, a real deep-seated feeling of satisfaction.
I saw a thing, it was beautiful, and now I know what it is.
Yeah, yeah. And that has, you know, in dribs and drabs, in small ways, just developed and snowballed to the point where now I will go out in the morning with a cup of coffee over into the sort of the fields opposite or above, and I will look for the birds, the songbirds. Well, just birds in general, but I think my favourite are the songbirds.
Well, I think in the UK, you've got to take what you can get, and our best are the songbirds.
Mm.
See that, or like magpies.
Yeah. And over the last couple of weeks, I've actually tried to start learning the calls, the songs.
Oh, yeah. Probably.
Yeah.
So you have an app?
No. What I do is I listen to the songs that are around. I try and isolate one. I try and track down the bird, you know, see it. And then I think, that maybe looks like a finch or a thrush or a, you know, tit. And then I will Google whichever category it is, and I will just listen to the calls until I hopefully hit upon the right one. And the feeling of joy when you do get the right one and it matches up, and you're like, oh my God, that is that. You know, that's a chiff chaff. Oh, that's a wren.
So some sort of built-in gamification to keep you motivated.
Dopamine
rush.
Yeah, but I think I like doing it that way as well, because it makes you listen to lots of different bird calls as well. So sometimes when you're with the next day, you'll be thinking, oh, what's that one? And then you think, I think I heard something that was a little bit like that, you know, yesterday when I was going through the, you know, the finches. Oh, maybe it's that. And then it, you know, I think it's a good way to learn and build up. Now, it might sound like I just want to be absolutely clear. I am very, very much at the foothills of knowledge about this.
And we're already in the top 5%.
Yeah, well, if you are a twitcher, a bird watcher, you're not going to find any sort of practical or meaningful technical discussion here, because I don't have the information. You know, so far I've managed to identify a coal tit, a sand martin, a wren, goldfinches. So not many. I mean, I know what a blue tit is, obviously. Skylarks. I'm lucky enough to live where there are skylarks. See them?
Yeah. You're in a good bit of the country for that. In stark contrast to me, I'm just jealous here, because obviously the number of songbirds I see in central London, it is just magpies. And rooks.
Pigeons.
There's some parakeets. Which probably shouldn't be there. But
yeah. The famous southeastern parakeets.
I saw one woman walking her parrot in the park the other day.
Walking?
Yeah, she was going to walk and her parrot was kind of hopping along from fence post to fence post with her.
Wow.
It's quite a big parrot.
London.
Yeah, you get all sorts here.
You do. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, so it's quite a different environment then that we're in. I can't say that I've seen anybody walking their parrot recently. It's quite eccentric. Get a different sort of eccentricity around here.
Yeah.
It's an eccentricity that's kind of hidden away in houses and sheds.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be parrots, but they won't be outside.
Anyway, so as I was saying, the it's not that I really have any deep bank of expertise or knowledge or anything, but I feel like I'm at the start of a journey that I feel very, very satisfied, but also quite wary about. Not because of the thing in itself. I don't feel wary about it per se. I mean, I love going out and looking at the songbirds and listening to them and so forth, but I'm sort of wary about what this says about me. You know, the cultural associations thereof.
I don't know, because I mean, you've got the sort of current cultural environment, but then you've got the sort of deep vein of you know, excellent British figures going back hundreds of years who you can tap into. You know, the great British naturalists of the 18th and 19th century. When I was young, I read a lot of the Gerald Durrell books.
Yeah,
and
so
also,
did I.
And also Willard Price, actually.
I never read Willard Price.
Children. American, but it is tales of two teenagers who go out to collect animals for their father's zoo. Two exciting places.
I did read one of those on your recommendation.
Yeah.
I remember.
Probably when you were 20 and it didn't quite hit, but when you were 12.
I think I was probably 24, but I don't know.
Gerald Dole transcends age bracket, but Willard Price does not. But I kind of wanted to be a naturalist. I kind of wanted to be Gerald Durrell with sort of a whole load of cages going around the countryside trying to find stuff. And I don't know what he did next.
You wanted to be Indiana Jones / a kind of rogue zoologist /
I still do.
An alien archaeologist, which I think all of those things do blend quite nicely. I think there's some synergy there.
Sadly, what I am is an accountant. But
you want to be sort of like a rogue trader, you know?
There is yet time.
Yeah, who goes around the galaxy sort of, you know, collecting valuable, rare specimens with a beard.
I just think it's kind of got to be in space now because kind of Earth stepped out.
Well, the land is anyway. Not sure about the sea, but I think the land is. Yeah, it's getting there.
It's a different vibe with fish.
Some people are really into spotting fish. Anyway, different thing. Different thing. Okay.
Yeah, I think what you're doing is more akin to the butterfly collectors and the beetle collectors.
Yeah. Well, we've said before, haven't we, how we're both neo-Victorians in our own different ways. But the person that I like to think of myself aiming towards in my head is actually Stephen Marturin from the Patrick O'Brien books, which I know that you have you read those? I can never remember.
I've read one now. I keep meaning to read more because I really enjoyed that one I read.
So good.
And the film is superlative.
Yeah, they're so good. But yeah, he knows, you know, he Stephen Marturin in the novels. This is possibly...
Yeah, so these novels, it's well, there are two main characters. One's the captain who's a man's man and one's his doctor, who's more learned, but is also a often frustrated naturalist.
Yeah, he's also very deadly with a pistol.
Ah, yeah, of course. I mean, that goes hand in hand.
Yeah, so they're both manly men in their own way, in different ways.
Back then, like, you couldn't do bird spotting because you didn't have binoculars and stuff. So if you wanted to identify a bird, you had to shoot it, and then you'd pick it up, and then you could identify it. It's only quite recent that the transition was made.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because I don't think I think many species are not particularly numerous at the moment.
Often because of this, I think there are lots of rare species in the world.
Yeah,
saw their demise from people trying to work out what they were.
So people who haven't read the novels are not necessarily fascinated by this comparison, but for those who have, they'll really get it. So those of you, those one or two listeners are out there who really get that. Thank you. You really got me there. Yeah. Thank you. Stephen Marturin in the Patrick O'Brien novels. So that's my happy little self-image of myself as I'm wandering around trying to identify, you know, a wren. There's something, isn't there, about the ability to name things.
Oh, yeah.
That is interesting and powerful.
There's a lot, isn't there? There's also... I mean, part of that, I think, is getting more information out of the same stimuli. I found, so I've done a bit of whitewater kayaking in my time. And when I look at a river, and especially a rapid, like most people look at a river, they just see a rapid. There's nothing more, no more information to get out of it. Whilst I see the stoppers, I see the tongues, I see the route that one might take, I see the hazards, I see the eddies. And to me, there's a whole load of information in this rapid that is there for everyone, but only a select few will ever have access to it. And I think there is a kind of joy in that. And not the joy of it not being widespread knowledge, but the joy of being able to look at something quite ordinary and get that extra bit out of it. And I imagine just being able to look at some birds and say, that one, it's migratory species.
You know, I think...
It sounds like this.
I think there is something in what you say. However, I actually do not think they are perfectly analogous. And I think there's quite an interesting little gap between those, actually, if I may. I think that...
Okay, go for it, yeah.
With your knowledge of the white water, I think that's quite embodied knowledge. I think that you have to have been in the white water. It's a type of knowledge that... You would feel that is derived from you interacting physically with that type of system, right? A little bit, I guess, like jiu-jitsu, you know, when you see I don't know when about you, but when I'm sure this is the case for you as well, but now when I see a clip of a boxing match or an MMA match or something online, I feel like I'm getting much more information out of it in the same way. Not because I'm any good at it, but just because I've been sort of roughly in the situation where you're having to do the same kind of thing. So I have just a little bit more embodied contextual information of, you know, what that might feel like.
Absolutely.
And what the dynamics of play are.
I was watching the most UFC just before this. And if you don't know much about it, when they're on the ground and they're just kind of hugging, it seems like, there's just nothing there for the audience unless they happen to know how technical the hugging is and what they're both trying to do.
Yeah.
And
technical wriggling.
Positions.
Technical wriggling. That's what I'd like to call it. So that's quite... I'm going to refer to this as embodied. So because you've interacted with that type of scenario or system physically, you have this kind of muscular knowledge of what needs to be done in certain situations. And I think that's kind of the form in which your additional information is packaged, isn't it? Because it's the knowledge of what you need to do with your body in that kayak, in that type of river.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of theoretical knowledge as well. Like, why is a stopper a stopper? Like, what's happened in the water to make that wave come out of nowhere? That you probably need to be told.
It still has a practical application, though, doesn't it?
I thought you were going to go down the practical application line with this comparison, but I'd argue that...
I think I am trying to. I don't think I'm being very articulate.
Knowledge of how to get down a rapid is more practical than being able to spot birds. Like, you have to go quite a long way out of your way for that knowledge to become useful.
No, but I think you're right. I think I'm just not being very good at expressing it. I'm trying to still use fancy words like embodied, when really what I mean is practical. It's a practical knowledge of how to do something. And there's theoretical in that, and there's also muscle memory in that.
Yeah.
And in that sense,
I mean, you're right, it is embodied. Yeah, you kind of feel what the eddy would do.
Yeah. Whereas I think that with bird spotting, there is no practical application other than the act in itself of identification. There is no practical application at all. It's not like we hunt these birds or we...
I mean, again... You rewind 100 years and there would be a hunting element, but also there would be, you know, information about the weather or the turning of the seasons, or if there's something else in that wood that they're worried at, and you can tell by their alarm calls. Like, they're just that, there is a knowledge I think you can get from a understanding of what the different birds are and how they behave and how they sound. That could be useful, just not in our current society.
Yeah. I mean, I was very pleased when I saw the sand martin, and I believe I identified it, because that would be the first migratory bird that I'd have seen. And that was on something like the 12th of April. And I thought, oh gosh, that's very early. That means that, you know, the Gulf Stream really is kicking in quite early this year and quite strong.
Here's what. So chickens have different alarm calls, depending on the sort of predator that they're reacting to. And they have a very specific one for airborne predators. And so my mother keeps a lot of chickens. And if you ever hear one go, That means airborne predator. And if you look up, you will see a bird of prey. Mm. And so that's verging on useful knowledge.
It's verging on useful knowledge. But the thing is that the reason you want to look up and see the bird of prey is, okay, you might want to protect your chickens, but presumably your chickens are already protected as far as they're going to be.
Yeah, you're mostly going to say, oh, cool, a bird of prey.
Exactly. You're mostly wanting to do it so that you can be like, oh, that's pretty cool. That's a sparrowhawk or whatever, you know. So I don't know, I think there is a difference in the sense that you're quite right that, you know, 100, 200 years ago, there might be a practical application. But that's certainly not...
But I mean, you know, the practical application of knowing how to read a whitewater rapid, you've also got to not be in your everyday... I mean, like, you're not going to just suddenly find yourself in a situation where you need that knowledge.
No, but I feel...
In some contexts, it can be useful.
Yeah, but you see, you know it because you enjoy throwing yourself down whitewater rivers in a kayak. Yeah, that's why you know it.
Mm.
I'm struggling to think of what the analogous practical application of why I want to know about birds, what it is.
Yeah, fair, I'll give you that.
Because I don't think the pleasure I get out of it is related to anything practical. Other than possibly having an excuse to be outside and pay attention to nature.
Mm.
Well, I mean, it's been my intention for ages to do a podcast discussing what we mean when we say nature. But putting that aside putting that aside for one moment, you know, there is that element that it's a good excuse to just wander outside and just immerse myself in a different environment. Mm. Because you can go for a walk and that's all well and good, but you need a...
Well, my problem with walks is that you need a reason to go on a walk, otherwise it feels a bit empty. Mm. So walking a dog is the age-old hack, because if you're walking a dog, that's a valid activity. Or climbing to the top of a specific hill, like I can get behind that. Or golf, I don't golf myself, but I kind of understand the idea of validating a walk. But just going for a walk on its own...
Mm.
Can feel a bit weird.
Yeah.
But if actually your purpose is to look at birds, then suddenly you can go on that walk with a clear conscience. You're doing something.
Yeah.
I
don't think this undermines your point at all. But it's not actually just the walking. It's just so quite often I'll just go outside and sit and wait and observe. I don't think that undermines your point because it's still an excuse to do that.
Just to actually sit outside without a book or your phone and just engage with the world around you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is quite... You don't tend to do that organically these days, but when it's actually really great.
Mm.
But you feel you shouldn't because you would be doing something.
It's quite like fishing to me, actually, because you have to wait. And if you wait, there's no guarantee... that you're going to see anything in the same way that there's no guarantee that you're going to catch fish. You just have to wait.
You definitely won't if you're not there.
Yeah. So it's quite meditative in that sense. Mm. And you are more often than not rewarded for your patience, but you can never quite tell how or where or what you're going to be rewarded with. So there is an element of continual uncertainty and surprise and delight whenever you do see anything. That's entailed by the, you know, the minutes or the chunks of time of boredom where you're not seeing anything. You know, that's what makes the little flash of wing.
It's not boredom because it's laden with promise. With
yes.
Purpose, with
yeah. Yeah. Whereas if you didn't have the promise,
it
would just be boring. Yeah.
If you just went out every time and just saw loads of amazing birds, that wouldn't, you know, you'd take them for granted pretty quickly.
Yeah, that wouldn't work at all. It's just the right level of elusiveness. It's just the right level of reward factor. And in that way, I guess it's working in a similar way as the cleverly, cunningly designed apps on our phone, which kind of hack into the same system. So it's a very good antidote to a phone, actually. In fact, I quite often just leave my phone indoors if I'm not wanting to do the calls, you know, identify the bird calls. But it's, you know, the phone is actually genuinely useful for that. I think, well, there's no point throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's something about the fact. So there's that. You're right. So we've established that, haven't we? That it justifies being outside, and it's entertaining for that reason. It's an activity
and healthy.
So maybe it is more similar to the kayaking. I don't know. I still feel that there's a slightly...
It's difficult because it is purely intellectual.
Mm. Okay. It is. It is. It's to do with naming, isn't it? There's this
classifying.
Yeah, and that's obviously a deep pool. Why do we like to classify? Anyway, there's a satisfaction to naming things. On top of this enjoyment of being outside that it justifies and allows you to enjoy. I think that being able to naming things is a power. It gives you, whenever you read about wizards, for example, in fiction, one of the things that distinguishes wizards is that they know the names of things and they know secret names. They know the names that other people don't know. And spells are a little bit like hidden names for powers. And the ability to say the spell is like the ability to say the name. And I think you see this in the 99 names of God and, you know, all of this kind of thing.
Yeah, all that Kabbalah stuff. And
The hidden name, the secret
name. The true name.
Yes, the true name. The knowledge, possession of the true name gives you a sort of occult possession of the thing. And I definitely feel that on an emotional level when I'm able to name a bird.
You sort of own it a little bit.
Yeah, in a weird, magical, occult-y kind of way. I think it also makes me think of the witches in Terry Pratchett. Big shout out to our Terry Pratchett listeners.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting round to Maud. I've now finished it.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. I need to read it again. But it makes me think of them as well, because, of course, the witches know a lot about the natural world, as it were, in inverted commas. Yeah. And therein lies a lot of their power. And, of course, they like to borrow, don't they? They ride on the minds of things like birds as one of their powers.
And also, they know the names of all the herbs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Part of the witch's trading, which is often said to be really boring, is, yeah, what's the name of that? What's the name of that? What's the name of that? And what's it do?
And Granny Weatherwax would know all of the birds, wouldn't she? The songbirds. And I think there's something quite witchy about it, in the sense as well that you can't control songbirds. And this is what we were just talking about. You can't make them appear for you. You have to just be patient. They will do it on their terms. You know, they will flash out of a tree, or they will just suddenly, you know, soar across your vision. When they decide to do it, you can't really compel them to do so. So there's that element, isn't there, of acceptance of the external or nature?
Yeah, I mean, you can use bird calls apparently to make, you know, make them do stuff, but that's looked down upon a bit in the. Because if you're trying to flash out a goldfinch and you have on your phone a goldfinch alarm call and you play it really loudly, you might provoke a reaction. But that'd be poor form.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about why that would be poor form. It's because it's antithetical to what is precise. It's antithetical to precisely what I'm talking about, which is what.
Well, it's like shooting a duck on the water. Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, you're right. You're trying to control what shouldn't be controlled, and you're causing some damage when doing it because you're creating stress in the animals and disrupting the natural behaviours.
Yes, and I think that's one of the rather lovely things about it, is that you are seeing the animals in their natural behaviour. You know, you're seeing the birds in their natural behaviour. You're not seeing them doing anything strange. You know, birds are, they inhabit a different medium from us. You know, they inhabit the air. And while, of course, they are affected by us as much as anything else, they don't seem to be. By living in this different element, the air, they seem to be living in a world that is, well, you know, separate from ours. You know, they fly above our concerns, in some sense.
They feel free. I mean, we've all sat in the hill and have watched the larks have swoop around and think, oh, they're so free.
Yeah, and you know, flitting in and out of the branches of the trees, and you know, navigating the world in such a different way and in such a different set of dimensions, they are entrancing and bewitching. I think that I think it's very telling that birds are often used as omens and metaphors in literature. I think they are quite often used as metaphors for the mental, for mental phenomena in literature, for thoughts and for things that happen in the mind. And I think the reason that is because they do inhabit this different medium, the air, the sky, which we associate sort of analogously and metaphorically with the mind and with consciousness.
Because, was it Bede who said that like being alive was like a sparrow that suddenly flies in through a window into a feasting hall, and there's all this light and sound and feasting. Mm. And it sort of goes along the whole length of the hall and then flies out the window back into the night.
Mm. You see,
they wouldn't work the same if it was a rat or something.
Well, yeah, that would be more TS Eliot. I feel like the birds, you know, when they flash out, you know, with their bright colours and their wings, and they're so quick and they dart here and they're usually on the peripheries on your vision. They're kind of like thoughts.
Mm.
As soon as you identify them, they're gone. And as soon as you notice them, they've sort of slipped through your fingers. And you know, you can't quite control them, exactly. But there's also the promise of beauty there. You know, and they come in from all directions. They're coming in they're not coming in like animals upon that walk the earth. You know, they're darting in from all of these different directions in the kind of the sensorium, which if you think of it as a sort of a, you know, 360 degrees, most of the sensorium is happening around the sort of the 90 and the 270 or whatever degree mark. You know, on the horizontal sort of plane.
Two-dimensional.
It's quite, but then the birds are so, you know, they're coming in from all directions and they're three-dimensional. I think that they are perfect metaphors for the mind and for our thoughts as they themselves flit about here and there as you kind of sit there. So I'm just trying to articulate what I think is, you know, the sense of the kind of the magical about birds.
Mm. Yeah.
I find that what I'm interested in is whether other people who are into bird watching think the same, or whether we, you know, whether they have the same reasons and feelings. I don't know.
I mean, you can't imagine all the great Victorian naturalists not feeling that.
Mm.
And again, the people who look at butterflies and beetles, butterflies in particular. There's a similar dynamic there.
Yeah, I think so. Classification, then. And we've talked about the power of naming things in a sort of roundabout way. I'm not quite sure I've managed to properly lay out what the power of naming something is, but it definitely has a power.
Yeah, I think we've been there before. Like you said, ant speaking your name metaphor.
Yes, that's a good one, yeah.
We have. To knowing the true name of a demon.
Yeah, we have been there. There's the practical aspect of getting out and having a reason for being there, which is great. And then there's the slightly more nebulous sense that they are sort of magical creatures because they inhabit a different medium from us. And of course the bright colours and the fact that their movements and their look, the way they present, is so different from mammals, because of course they're not mammals. They're quite alien in that sense.
Yeah, they're dinosaurs.
Yeah, they're dinosaurs. They're literally dinosaurs. So they're quite magical creatures.
Yeah.
But then there's, so classification. It's the other thing.
We came across a bit when we were talking about In Praise of Darkness.
Mm.
That, sort of saying it's quite a...
In Praise of Shadows.
European desire. That we like to put things in boxes to help us understand them.
Mm.
And especially your average Englishman, we like things to be categorized so that we can then use a slightly abstracted knowledge of the category rather than the individual.
I think I wonder to what extent this is something that's quite fundamental to European civilization, you know.
Well, I mean, I think it's the reason behind a lot of what we did. Do you ever hear about the census in India in 1872, I think?
I did not. Tell me about the census in India in 1872.
Well, so religion in India was always quite a bit of a spectrum. Each village would have its own slightly different religion, and you know their own village gods and things like that.
Mm.
But as you got further west, or in some places, that village god might be the Prophet Muhammad. But it wouldn't be seen as a sort of distinct religion from the next door village where it's, you know, some Hindu god.
Mm.
They didn't have a sense that Islam was distinct from Hinduism.
Mm.
And then in this census...
They do now.
the English... We went from village to village, you know, doing a census of each village, going to headman, like how many people live here and stuff like that. And one of the questions was, are you Muslim or are you Hindu? And this just hadn't been a question that had been asked before. It wasn't something anyone thought of. But suddenly we asked them to classify themselves as one of these two things. And then not many years later, we're having to partition the whole country because these two categories hate each other so much.
Mm. Is that really true? They saw them as a continuum before then?
This is the narrative I've heard.
Okay.
I think that there are other explanations you could overlay on top.
Other narratives are available.
Yeah, but this one's quite an interesting one.
I mean,
it sort of shows that the Western desire to classify as not just antithetical to most of the world, but also profoundly alien and extremely damaging if used incorrectly.
I want to be clear that I find it very plausible. I suspect that narrative is one of those narratives that is not entirely true.
Yeah, the fact that it sounds so plausible makes me suspect it a bit. But
there's an element of truth in it that's actually the most important thing, and that element is the important thing.
There's a similar narrative around Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda, that it was the colonial authorities there who created the difference, but that one is false.
Right.
So they are legitimately different.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but
that was the French.
That was the...
Just a
bloody French. well, in that case, I believe it. I take your point, and I suspect the element of truth that matters is there, because the point is that by classifying the world, you change it.
Yeah.
You'd think that classifying something is a neutral act ontologically, but it isn't. When you name something, when you classify it, when you set it in relationships to others, formal grammatical relationships of nomenclature and meaning, I think you change its ontology in quite a subtle but quite profound way.
You do, and then you've also got that thing of what categories you're using. Category theory is its whole thing. I've had this in a few previous jobs where you're trying to understand something, but like food waste. So I was in food waste. How do you classify food waste into buckets that are useful?
Mm.
Like chips, are chips from these two different suppliers, are they different categories? Like, should you actually be classifying by supplier, or by the fact they're chips, or by the fact they're potatoes, by their cost, or like there's so many angles you can classify from, that if you're just trying to put one classification approach on top of messy reality, you lose a lot of detail. So you gain a lot of utility, but you're missing some of the story deliberately to do that.
And this goes right back to Platonism, doesn't it? If the idea that there's an ideal form, i.e. an ideal... There is a true category to which everything belongs. You could put Platonism in those terms, and the true category exists in the realm of the forms, this kind of perfect world where, you know, the perfect circle exists and every other circle that we see is just an imperfect copy. But each one belongs to the category circle because it is an imperfect reflection of this original perfect form.
Yeah.
And that, you know...
Sorry,
Plato is very deep in the Western psyche, so, you know, that could be a part of it. I'm just thinking of the other great strand, of course, that underlies our civilization in the West is Christianity. And I'm just thinking, I'm just immediately thinking of, you know, in the beginning was the Word. You know, Christianity actually sets the Word before the reality.
And if you fast forward a bit as well, like one of Adam's first tasks is to name all the animals.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is that thing, isn't there, that by speaking the Word... It's an act of creation. It's not a passive act. It's an act of generation. But the example from food waste that you were saying is that actually this is a practice that has its power from cutting out some of the complexity that exists in the real.
And that is how the West made all those scientific advances during the Enlightenment and stuff like that. It is, you can't just analyze everything. You've got to select the detail that's useful to you or interesting to you, and you can classify that. But there's quite a funny...
sorry to interrupt, but that's exactly it then, isn't it? That you've hit the nail on the head. That is how you change the world by naming things, is that you you isolate it and you set it
you
in...
You say, this dimension's the important one.
Yeah. And have once you've isolated a specific part of it, the part that presents itself to you as relevant, you can then start to manipulate it. Or learn about it, or whatever you're going to do with it. But the point is that you've got it. It's almost like you've pinned it down, like a butterfly collector will pin down his butterfly. And what was chaotic and real and natural and, you know, flapping around is now pinned, and it's got a label under it, and you've got it. You can study it. And I think that naming does that. Identifying, classifying, it does that. Sorry, I interrupted you.
But you've also got to define the boundaries of what that thing is, because I mean, especially with animal species, there's a lot of variance within a species. You know, the wagtails will have a huge diversity to them, and so how do you fence off the one that is that particular blue-nosed wagtail or whatever you're talking about, and what is not? I think there's a lot of debate around that, like, well, what's a species, what's a subspecies, where do we draw the line, especially since a lot of species can hybridize, can mate with each other to create, you know, something else.
Yeah.
What's your basis for making the cut there?
Well, I mean, that's just it, isn't it? You know, the cut is the word. That's the cut. It's the cut is the one that you're willing to point at and say pied wagtail, versus the one that you're not willing to point at and say pied wagtail. And that actually goes right to the heart of language and, you know, the philosophy of language itself. And I know that philosophers have lots of different theories about the philosophy of language, but a lot of them are wrong. And I know that because I've taught a two-year-old to speak. And I'll tell you how language works. This is how language works, right? It is the correspondence between a gesture and a sound. So you point at something and you make the right sound that is the word. And then the two-year-old will look at you, look at where you're pointing, and listen to what you've said. And then they will point at it and make the sound. And you go, yes, and smile at them. And they'll
usage
be very pleased.
Meaning, as Wittgenstein said.
It's correspondence. It's correspondence. Yeah. Words get their meaning from the correspondence with the real. You know, it corresponds to something, a phenomenon. And that's where the cut is what you're willing to make was what you're willing to use the word for.
Yeah. Did you ever come across Borges's Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge? It was his kind of critique of any attempt to categorize the world or organize things. And I think he was looking at someone who created a scheme of just categorizing everything. And he came up with this one, which is the conceit was he'd found a Chinese encyclopedia and looking at how that categorized everything in the world. And the categories were, I've got them here. There's those belonging to the emperor.
Oh, yeah, no, I have
embalmed
read this.
Ones. Yeah. Trained ones, suckling pigs, mermaids, fabled ones, stray dogs. Those included in this classification. Those that tremble as if they were mad, innumerable ones. Those drawn with a very fine camel hair brush, etc. Those that have just broken the vase. And those from afar look like flies.
But the point is that that classification system would have no utility. Or one
exactly.
Assumes.
Whilst the ones we came up with in the West did have utility, and we use them to create science as we know it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because in the beginning of the world, before it was the word, before you could have the power, you had to have the words. And then it's from applying the words and classifying things and cutting them up, cutting the world up into little pieces, then you got the power.
Yeah. Or was it Plato who said you should carve reality at the joints?
Like, I don't know. That's a nice phrase.
Places where you should be cutting.
Yeah.
And it's pretty obvious. But also, if you cut in the wrong place, then that's not going to help you. Like, you're creating a whole load of extra effort.
So I think that there's an impulse to control that sits underneath the habit of classification or the desire to classify. It's all about control.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true for train spotting and stamp collecting as much as it is for bird watching. But what I would say about bird watching is it's got that admixture of the uncontrollable, the birds themselves.
I think what it's also got that we haven't talked about yet is hunting.
Mm.
We are predators. We like to hunt. We don't hunt much. And I think in going out to try and see a certain bird, we're satisfying that urge.
I hadn't thought of that. Because it is the hunt, isn't it? I'm hunting for something.
And it's quite a similar skill set as well. Like when you're hunting, there's a lot of time spent very still waiting for the animal to appear.
Mm. Yeah.
You need the same knowledge of the animal to be able to hunt it.
Yeah, that's very true.
You need to know what it sounds like.
You need to know what it likes to do, where it likes to hang out.
Yeah.
At what time of day. Hmm.
And so actually, I mean, when you said you wanted to talk about bird spotting, the first thing that came to mind was one of my favourite books of all time, which is Man-Eaters of Kumaon by Jim Corbett, who was...
I mean, first of all, very on brand. How have I not heard of this one before? It's one of your favourite books of all time. Never bloody mentioned it.
Well, it's quite a specific book.
Okay.
It's by Anglo-Indian. So he worked on the railways in India. So he was in charge of the station that transshipped cargo from ships on the Ganges onto the railway.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very good at it. And that was his passion. But he was also an incredible hunter. And he didn't really like hunting. So especially as he got into middle aged, he didn't really like killing the animals. But this book is just a series of accounts of when he's kind of reluctantly brought out of retirement to kill some man-eating tiger in some far-flung corner of India. Once it's killed a couple of hundred people, once all the other hunters have tried and just haven't managed to get this tiger, they finally ring up Jim Corbett, who's like, well, I'm busy today on the railway, but maybe... and he'd eventually go and then, you know, track it down and kill it. But he, after a long career of doing that, you know, he became very famous for this.
So to be clear, this is a real person. This isn't
a real person.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he was actually with...
Is he British or Indian or British Indian or what?
So it was his grandparents who had moved to India.
Okay.
He was seen as a... He wasn't quite an expat. He was Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sort of. He wasn't quite English, but he obviously wasn't Indian either. He was in that kind of, good luck classifying that.
Yeah.
I think his grandparents had been a monk and a nun who had eloped from England to India.
Nice.
He was actually with Queen Elizabeth the night she became queen. He was her bodyguard in a hotel in Kenya. When she got the news. And this is phase two of his career, because he just didn't like killing animals. And whenever he killed one of these man-eaters, he made a big point saying, look, this isn't the natural behavior of tigers. If they're eating humans, they're in pain, they've been injured, they're weak. And he'd always make a point, say, look, this one had broken teeth, or like this one had a bullet stuck in his shoulder from when someone tried to kill it.
Mm.
But obviously he was really good at this and loved it. Deep down. And he managed to transition that in the early days of photography into photographing animals instead. And so all the same skills and desires that led him to be this great hunter turned him also into a pioneer of wildlife photography. Mm. And actually in those days, with those cameras, you had to get even closer to the animal than if you were trying to hunt it.
Mm.
But other than that, it's the exact same skill set. And so, yeah, he became...
This guy lived your perfect life, didn't he? Bastard. He got there. Yeah. He had it.
Well, but he also had the boring admin job. There's one of my favourite lines of all literature is...
You would have loved loading a railway. Oh, my God. You'd have been
He said something like...
In seventh heaven.
I had a really exceptionally good year. Not only did I beat the record of tonnage of goods transshipped from the Ganges onto the railway, but I also killed the man-eater of Kanda, or something like that. But he put them in that order. Like the tonnage of goods transshipped was actually a bit more important to him than killing these famous tigers.
Amazing. Well, yeah, it's very it's very flattering of you to sort of implicitly locate me in the tradition of this man, Jim. Was it Jim Corbett?
Yep.
With my sort of half hour little sojourn amongst the songbirds of a morning.
Like 200 years ago, you might have been killing them, and now you're looking at them, but with the same skills and the same instincts.
I mean, you can kind of see those instincts coming out in lots of different ways in my life, can't you? Because I was drawn towards the rifle club at university, where we first met. And then, I've done a few different things that would
suggest... Well, a lot of outdoor activities. I mean, you're running and stuff like that. I mean, what are you doing other than simulating a hunt? I'm not sure.
A pointed comment. I mean, point taken. Yeah, I guess it is a bit like that. And actually, you know what? Yesterday, I was wandering around on the hill, having a great time. And there was one point which I was trying to work out where this particular call was coming from. You know what I did? I crouched down.
Yes.
I just did it without even thinking about it. I just crouched down and stayed very still for about 15 minutes.
The ancient blood starting to come
up. Yeah, I know, yeah. And then I got up and my legs were killing me, you know, like, oh my God, it hurt. For about 5 minutes, because I'm quite old. And I thought, why did I do that? And I was just, the pain made
me... Pure instinct.
The pain made me reflect on what I'd just done and why. And I was thinking, yeah, that was a very instinctive thing to do. I don't really know why I did that. But now I do. I do know why. I was on a hunt.
Yeah.
Smell the blood.
Felt good.
Yeah. Well, no, I couldn't. Because I wouldn't... I mean, it's the I actually have a kind of a horror of the idea of killing any of these songbirds. I think that's the irony here. But I think that you're right. It's like the abstraction of a hunt, isn't it? Something is abstracted. The blood is abstracted in the same way that I guess that... I mean, when we're talking about sacrifice, you've kind of removed the actual act of killing in the Christian version.
Probably later that day you'd have eaten some meat. And deep down your body connects those two things.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, it's another way in which our lives have become dislocated from reality. You know, those two things that should be connected are now not. Mm. And so we experience a vague sense of malaise.
Yeah, unless you go out and look at birds, in which case...
Mm. But even then, you know, you feel like you're reaching after something intangible, and you're sort of getting close to it, but you never quite grasp it. Which I quite like, but maybe that's just a feature of my...
But that's also integral to the hobby, isn't it? There's always another bird to spot.
Mm.
There's always another species to see.
Mm. Yes, very interesting. Well, there we go. There's a revelation. I thought I'd, you know, puzzled it all out, but actually the key element, hunting... was missing all along.
Yeah, so you're unifying the kind of higher brain intellectualizing and classification, the spiritual needing to name something, and then the instinctual lower brain bit of hunting.
I actually think the spiritual bit is, you're right about the naming, but I actually think the spiritual bit that I take from it is more about
the
what
beauty,
I was...
Sorry, yeah, yeah,
yeah, what I was, what about I was that, yeah. carping on about, you know, different mediums in the mind and metaphors and so forth. That's what I like to reflect on. When I'm seeing them and so forth, which I'm sure is all a load of nonsense, but it makes me happy. So there you go. I've given you the benefit of it.
And I think we've got a good framework as to why it does that.
Yeah,
and why it's okay.
It's okay.
No, it's not lame.
Okay, that's
not antisocial.
That's
actually really good.
Mm.
You should do more of it. You should get more into it.
Oh, I need to get some binoculars because I've been doing it all with the naked eye, which is quite hard.
And notebook. Yeah, and anorak.
Yeah. Yes. There it is. There's the little dig.
Yeah. I'm just jealous.
Yeah.
You can look down on me.
Yeah.
I'm not doing a hunt every day.
No.
I'm not appreciating the beauty because there is none in London.
I actually think I happen to live in quite a good place for this, you know.
You live in a superb place, yeah.
Mm. We hear the owls as well at night, and you see the birds of prey circling above, and it's all rather wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be lovely.
I realised, though, that something I'd thought of my whole life as a cuckoo is actually a collared dove, which is very embarrassing. You know those sort of...
kind of hoot in the way. Yeah,
it's a hoot. It's a soft hoot that sounds like a sort of a... Hoo,
hoo.
Yeah. My whole life, I've thought those are cuckoos. It's not. It's a dove.
That's a relief, isn't it? Don't like cuckoos.
Well, apparently cuckoos, it used to be quite frequent to hear a cuckoo in spring in Britain, but it's very rare now. I mean, which I guess it has in a way, but I was reading something that made the point that it's very difficult for us to preserve them as a species because they're so transient to the British Isles. You know, they're one of these birds that doesn't actually spend very long here. So, you know, we're only a small part of that.
Soon the Mediterranean's to shooting them as they go overhead.
Yeah. And I also, you know, birds are just really fascinating. I think we end on, maybe unless you've got anything else to add, end on the note that I was looking into sort of sand martins and swallows and swifts and so forth. And, you know, they go, obviously, we all know that they migrate to Africa every year, right? But when you actually think about that, I mean, that is mind-blowing, isn't it?
And they can do it without having done it before.
Mental.
They just know where to go.
Apparently a swallow or a swift or something will fly 2 million miles in its lifetime. And they go down to these forests in South Africa, or Southern Africa, rather, and nobody quite knows where. Still a mystery. Nobody knows exactly where they go. Isn't that wonderful?
That is great.
And then they turn up back here, you know, on the river, and I see them, you know, walking to work or walking to, you know,
in the autumn, they gather on the telegraph poles.
As I say, they live in a different medium from us, and that's...
They do.
That's rather wonderful. So anyway, there we go. Confession made.
No, I think there's no need for guilt. I think everyone would be better off if they followed your example.
Thank you. That's very kind. That's very kind. So it's your turn now to confess about something that is creeping up on you now that you're heading towards middle age. I've done it. Bird watching.
I haven't built a model railway, but I'm not saying it's not something I would do.
Yeah. It's a time thing, isn't it, at the moment? Maybe a space thing.
Yeah, the judgment thing as well.
Well, I wouldn't judge you. I bloody love a model railway.
I've got plans.
Yeah.
Yeah. The world of Marvel.
Right. My dad was a big model railway guy. Mm. So, you know, there's no point in me fighting it. And he used to put toast for me in the morning on a sort of freight train model, and then he'd ride it round to me, which, when you're four, is rather wonderful.
It doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, so that goes in quite deep. But I'm sure that given time, space, resources, and opportunity, or means, motive, and opportunity, rather. I've got the motive. Means and opportunity.
Yeah.
It will happen. Yeah. My wife is hopefully not listening.
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah.
I don't think she'd understand.
No, she wouldn't understand. She'll just have to... We'll just have to spring it on her as a surprise. Yeah, no, she hasn't heard. It's all good. Right, anyway, we're going to leave it there before we give away any...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, adieu. Till next time.
Bye.